I'm Dr. Nathaniel Chin, and you're listening to Dementia Matters, a podcast about Alzheimer's disease. Dementia Matters is a production of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Our goal is to educate listeners on the latest news in Alzheimer's disease research and caregiver strategies. Thanks for joining us. I'm on location at the Penn Memory Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My guest is physician and writer Jason Karlowish. Dr. Karlowish is a professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, as well as co-director of the Penn Memory Center. He has investigated the development of Alzheimer's disease treatments and diagnostics, biomarker-based concepts of disease, informed consent, quality of life, research and treatment decision-making, and voting by persons with cognitive impairment and residents of long-term care facilities. His writing on aging and dementia has appeared in numerous publications, including Forbes, the New York Times, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. In 2014, Dr. Karlowish founded MakingSenseOfAlzheimer's.org, an online community for people to understand the past, present, and future of Alzheimer's disease. Thank you, Dr. Karlowish, for being on Dementia Matters.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here, Nate.
So you are a geriatric physician and a researcher, and prominent in both. You see patients and participants. But how do you define Alzheimer's disease? Which I know sounds like an easy question, but in truth it isn't.
Of course, it isn't. You're absolutely right. There's so much nuance in this disease that what starts out seeming so simple and big is actually huge and complex. And fraught with nuance. And so, you know, the conversation, you know, what's Alzheimer's, I find it fascinating. You know, you go give a talk in the community and, you know, you're guaranteed that one question, almost like the disease itself repeating a question in the community, that the community has it, if you will, it being Alzheimer's, which is what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? And, you know, I've reflected on this a lot because, like, you know, I go wondering, like, do people not understand the difference between categories and kinds? You know, like the category of fruits and then the kinds of fruits, bananas, apples, the category of dogs and then the kinds of dogs, you know. And then they do. I think people get that. I don't think that that's a conceptually difficult concept. I think the problem, of course, are the emotions that are attached to the words Alzheimer's and the emotions that are attached to the words dementia. And I think those emotions cause people to have very different understandings of what those things are, and therefore the notion that Alzheimer's is a kind within the category of the dementias, I think for people, many people, is just this jarring, just it doesn't work, not logically, but emotionally. So anyway, you know, I try, though, still the standard category kind thing. You know, there's this thing called dementia, and this is what it is, and Alzheimer's is a cause of it. And of course, if they have MCI, I'm a proponent of the value of the MCI diagnosis caused by a disease, depending on obviously the patient. And then I kind of try to go for Alzheimer's, you know, that it is ultimately a biological diagnosis. I think that there is pathology there. I mean, we know that what it is might be different than what we think it is. In the future, it might be different. So my idea of Alzheimer's is that it is a disease caused by a pathology or pathologies. You know, it can present either as the MCI or dementia syndrome.
And would you agree that a part of the confusion in the community is that there's been a lot of confusion among providers, the way that our primary care providers, our specialists, our hospitals, they often use the word interchangeably too.
Yeah, well, sure, yeah. They do, and part of that is the branding issue. So there's the emotions that surround the words dementia and Alzheimer's. So, you know, no one talks about being pleasantly Alzheimer'd, but there is this idea of being pleasantly demented. So depending on your emotions around either of those words, putting them together and seeing them as part and parcel can be difficult. The other issue is the branding, that the brand of Alzheimer's kind of has been stretched to its limits. And it all began in 1970, when there was this kind of entente that will use Alzheimer's to denote a specific disease, but also it'll kind of be the overarching term that captures the general problem. And the problem is that brand like Levi's or Kleenex or Coca-Cola or IBM has kind of gotten stretched to its limits of meaning. And I think there's a third reason, which is just quite frankly just misunderstanding, ignorance, and stigma, which make it difficult to use one word or the other word, and so people avoid using the words, or they use otherwise, avoid saying the words because they view them as stigmatizing.
No, you're a leader in the field of biomarker disclosure. I'm starting with genetic risks like APOE4, but now with elevations in the amyloid protein that you're just referring to. So why is studying disclosure important?
Well, I think it's, let's look at other diseases. You know, I think if you ask someone, do you have diabetes? They'll say, yes, I have diabetes, or no, I don't. And especially those who say, yes, they do. So why do you have diabetes? And they say, well, they might have two stories. One story is, over a couple of weeks or months, I started to get really fatigued and tired and urinating a lot, et cetera. And then I finally went to the emergency room even, or the doctor, and it turns out I had a glucose of 800. And I was told I had diabetes. So that's a classic sort of signs, symptoms, suffering that led me to seek help, that led to a diagnosis. And the other way, of course, it's diagnosed is I was kind of fine, and then I went to the doctor, and among the tubes of blood that were taken, it turns out one of them went off and got not just a glucose, but a glycosylated hemoglobin, and they said, your glycosylated hemoglobin is 9, you've got diabetes. And I, what are you talking about? I feel fine. Et cetera. And, for many, they ultimately take that note, they instantiate that test result into a diagnosis and adopt a disease label and a lifestyle of being a person with diabetes and a way of thinking about themselves. And they change life behaviors, or they don't, but they make a choice. Like, I've been told to do X, but I'm not going to do that, or I am doing that. What X might be, exercise or weight loss. I've been told to take metformin, and I'm taking it, or I'm not taking it, etc. Or I'll do metformin, but I won't do the needles, insulin, whatever. The point is that there's a whole disease world that surrounds that. So what we've been very interested in is, all right, back to the brain. If I define the brain disease not so much by your story, which you're going to tell me, but rather by the results of tests, how will you adopt that disease label, and how will you behave after that? And what I think is fascinating about that disease label compared to anything below the neck is, our brains are a privileged organ for our ability to exercise our personhood, or even more importantly, our autonomy, our self-determination. And so what you're telling someone is, I know you think you feel fine, but I'm actually going to tell you that there's something now which is a big threat to your self-determination. And so that sort of ups and the ethical ante of why I think studying how people understand and then appreciate and then behave after they learn a biomarker result for a neurodegenerative disease is incredibly important if that's going to become a new area of practice. Because, of course, it's not right now. You still have to have a story of suffering. You still have to have some cognitive problems that are causing trouble in your life to then say, well, let's look into this and do some testing with biomarkers. And even there, though, I find is sort of, and then I'll stop, that individuals who learn a biomarker result, I think, is a very different experience than just learning the clinical explanation of them.
So what have you learned from your studies of amyloid disclosure?
Yeah, so let's focus on humans who are cognitively unimpaired, who are older, they learn whether they have elevated or not elevated amyloid. And we've studied a population of individuals who learned it in order to be able to take an experimental medication as part of a clinical trial that was targeting the amyloid. And we interviewed them after they learned the result, and then we went back and interviewed them about a year later. And what we find is we looked at, obviously, individuals who both learned they had elevated amyloid and individuals who had not elevated. And I think the advantages of that design were a number of them. Number one, the ability to look over time how people changed or not, and more importantly, between those two groups, and that ability to draw contrast, which is sort of a fundamental sort of tool of science, is compare something to something else to make inferences about things. And what you find is, you know, it's high-octane news to learn that you do or don't have elevated amyloid. For those who don't have elevated amyloid, it's a source of relief. It becomes news to share with other people. It's something that doesn't change behavior. In contrast, if you learn you have elevated amyloid, you kind of see people then begin to divide into different groups. No one's relieved, but some say, well, this is what I expected. You know, I'm having horrible problems with word retrieval and memory. And mind you, these are cognitively unimpaired people, but they think their cognition has changed. And so this explains it. I get it. That's what I expected. I have a strong family history, etc. And generally what we found is many people had that theme. And some, therefore, then were quite, I'm not bothered by it, so be it. But there was another group of folks we find for whom this is high-octane information. It causes them to be worried. It causes them to rethink what their future will be like, how much time they have left. And once you start playing with someone's sense of their time horizon, you change behavior. Any microeconomist will tell you that. You know, I mean, time horizon is a driver of why people do or don't make choices, given how much temporal discounting they can engage in. You know, do I feel I have unlimited time or short time? So, and then people struggle with how they should share the result. You go to a dinner party and everyone's chatting about their hemoglobin A1Cs or their cholesterol levels. Let's hope they don't talk about their colonoscopies, but some do. And their bone mineral densities, etc. Their PSAs. This is a value that's a little different than that. And, you know, many people discern very closely who they're going to tell and why they're going to tell it to them because they're concerned that people will treat them differently. Family members, friends, co-workers. So it's different than other medical tests.
What do you think are the benefits, though, then of learning one's status?
I think the only benefit of learning an amyloid result or a tau result in someone who's cognitively unimpaired, and I have to qualify your question, is to participate in a study that would examine two things. One, the impact of a therapeutic intervention on the natural history of cognition in individuals with that result. So a drug study. I think there's also a warrant to learn that result in a study to understand how people live with and make sense of that result as well. So I think it's best learned in the context of a study to better understand it. In contrast, I think in individuals who have cognitive impairment that meets, you know, clinical definitions for either MCI or dementia, I think there's a role for learning it to better understand the cause of my cognitive problems. There, though, I think people still have to discern carefully. I certainly have had some patients with MCI who, frankly, it didn't help them to learn that they had elevated amyloid, and therefore this was likely caused by Alzheimer's. I've had a couple cases where I've caused harm that I think people wish they hadn't learned whether they had something neurological. On the other hand, I've had people who found it, that knowledge is power, and I'm glad I know it. What explains why I have my cognitive problems. So there, I think that in the individuals who have MCI or dementia, I see a clinical role for it in the hands, I think, of a careful prescriber.
You speak a lot then to informed consent and letting people know what we don't even know about
right. What
we're disclosing.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we're doing an adequate job of providing informed consent?
So I think one of the challenges that will emerge for the field is in the cognitively unimpaired space, if we start to use these tests clinically, what is our practice? Does our practice encourage people, for example, that before we get this test, and certainly before I tell you the result, you know, you need to talk to other people in your family, and I want them to someone to come in with you. Because, you know, this is the result our research says that, that ramifies. You know, is that an obligation? Should we make that our default? Now, someone could say, look, I don't want anyone else to come in. I don't want them to know. But then should we engage in, you know, that's fine, but you need to understand that, you know, you're going to learn information for which, for example, it's going to impact people around you, and you may start to need to make decisions that would impact them, like employment, where we live. If cognitive problems develop, which they might, you know, who's going to watch over you, et cetera. And so I think the field needs to have a real rigorous discussion now, you know, in the informed consent to get these tests. How much is that an informed consent? That's just you as the individual monadic patient for whom I'm going to have this dialogue and we go ahead with it, versus we need to create kind of almost a shared kind of decision amongst you and some other people. Or at least I have the obligation to encourage you to do that. You can walk away and say, I don't want anyone else to know I'm doing this on my own. But my default is, you know, you need to bring someone else in here.
So then where do you feel like the field of Alzheimer's in general is heading, knowing that we're facing more of these ethical challenges, informed consent challenges, but that biomarkers are very much a part of our research practice?
Yeah, well, biomarkers are redefining the disease. They haven't yet redefined the treatment of the disease. And I think until that happens, the field's in kind of this, fraught area, that these tests are sort of floating around out there, slowly creeping into clinical practice. And yet there really isn't a solid clinical model for their deployment and use and reimbursement. If the present state of affairs endures for years and years, I think it's going to become increasingly contentious. As data accumulate for the value of various markers to predict, you know, on what basis should a clinician offer them and why, what's the value in that compared to the many other things clinicians can do for patients, all the other tests we can order. And I'm sort of worried about that kind of, you know, clinical policymaking nightmare, because there are potentially millions of people who plausibly could get some of these tests. And as well in the clinical space, and meaning people with clinical disease who have mild cognitive impairment and dementia. You know, once you put therapy in the mix, you know, right away it changes the equation, because, you know, the test is linked to a therapy. It creates its own set of challenges, though, because, you know, is the therapy worth it? And when I worth it, I mean, you know, how long should you take it, and how would you know it's working? And all the complexities around, you know, weighing its risks and benefits and costs will become a new part of a dialogue that we haven't had as a field ever, really. I mean, we pretended to have it with the cholinesterase inhibitors, but I think many of us look back on that era with a bit of a kind of a shoulder shrug and a, you know, whatever. That could be a much higher octane and very different world when we have therapies. We say, you know, quote, attack the disease. Just to develop the point a little bit more, I think we should anticipate a future where the diseases are redefined by these markers. And we may even see the term Alzheimer's fade away. And instead, what will rise up are ways of talking about the disease that are defined by the drugs and the tests. That I've got a treatment refractory amyloidosis of my brain, you know. I've got a spreading tauopathy that's been responsive to anti-tau therapy. And I think that actually could liberate us from some of the sort of 20th century cultural and baggage that surrounds these diseases. It may redefine the stigma experience, for example. Once we can retire Alzheimer's and replace labels like, you know, based on biology and whatnot. So that's just a thought about a future.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank you for being on Dementia Matters.
Well, you're welcome. It was a pleasure, Nate.
Dementia Matters is brought to you by the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. The Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center combines academic, clinical, and research expertise from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the Geriatric Research Education and Clinical Center of the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. It receives funding from private, university, state, and national sources, including a grant from the National Institutes of Health for Alzheimer's Disease Centers. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and edited by Abishir Adin. Our musical jingle is Cases to Rest by Blue Dot Sessions. Check out our website at adrc.wisc.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you have any questions or comments, email us at dementiamatters@medicine.wisc.edu. Thanks for listening.